the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, thanks for joining us for another Wednesday rip of the CBP. My name is Joey. You already know that I'm here tonight with a great guest. Matt Odell is going to be joining us making his CBP debut. But first, as always, the sponsor of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, EasyDNS. Len and I, as you guys know, trying to like struggle through making a website. It's hard. But EasyDNS, Mark Jaftovic, the owner, they make it easy. They've helped us so far move our GoDaddy domain over. They've put us in touch with the right people on the tech side as far as building the website. Mark, I mentioned this the other day, is actually working with my wife who speaks the language to get the website up. But probably most importantly, given the background and the problems we've had getting stuff like bank accounts and other kind of, you know, fiat assistance with the business, with the podcast, you're uncancelable over at EasyDNS. And if you're ever looking to make a website, do a little hosting, any of that stuff, let us know, let Mark know. They will help you. They'll make sure that whatever you're posting stays up, no matter how mad it makes people, no matter how upset the complainers get. And look out, by the way, this week for something from the CBP and EasyDNS. Like I said, or teased on Twitter, an expansion of the weekly catalog. So yeah, we're looking forward to that. I'm going to bring on our guest. Matt is here. Matt, it's good to see you. I see you're wearing your 1031 hat. We're going to talk about that tonight for sure. But before we get started, how you doing there?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, I mean, we've had your colleague, co-host, friend, Marty on before, and he had some things to say about you near the end of the show. I'm going to give you a chance to respond to near the end of this program as well. But first, You've been around for a long time, Matt, and you know I've heard you discuss kind of how you got into Bitcoin, your first foray, but a lot of our listeners are 2020, 2021 vintage. So if you could, tell us about your jump into Bitcoin. How'd you find this thing, man?
First off, I wanted to publicly apologize to Joey because we've been trying to make this conversation happen for a long time, and it's mostly been my fault planning wise, but I'm glad we finally made it happen, and it's truly a pleasure to be here. I don't know, Bitcoin, how did I discover Bitcoin? It was I guess it was like 11 years ago now, 2012. I was told about Bitcoin by a buddy who was buying drugs on the Silk Road. Completely dismissed it. Right. The government's going to stop it. There's no way this thing will work. I guess I should start previously. 2008 financial collapse happens. Right. I'm a young kid. I look at it. I basically say there's no adults in the room. Right. Everyone pretends they know what they're doing. Obviously, the majority of people have no clue what they're doing. There's no experts. It completely like flipped the script on my perspective of the world in the 2008 financial collapse. Then 2012, I get introduced to Bitcoin, completely dismiss it. Then 2013, I get reintroduced to Bitcoin by a different friend. And this kid was a straight edge developer. So completely different than the first kid who introduced me to it. And I'm like, how do these two different types come together and coalesce on this thing called Bitcoin and suggest it to me, right? Then in 2013, we had the Snowden leaks happen. And at that point, I was pretty skeptical of our government. I didn't really trust our government. I didn't trust our authority figures, but I thought maybe, you know, the tech companies, you know, Google said, don't be evil, right? Like I didn't necessarily believe that they weren't going to be evil, but I didn't think we were going to see the kind of collusion that we saw in the Snowden leaks, where basically all these tech companies were used against us. They were all colluding or coerced. They were either forced to or they did it voluntarily to surveil and control us, right? So at that point, I have like this, it like kind of comes together in my mind that we can't trust these closed source tech companies. Our financial system is who the fuck knows, right? I mean, if people listen to my shows, they know like I've When we have full financial collapse, like, I'm not going to say told you so, because I've just been calling it since like 2008, right? But so the financial system, I was already skeptical of, the tech companies that I was skeptical of. And then I came into Bitcoin, and all of a sudden, you know, a disenfranchised youth, I looked at Bitcoin, and Bitcoin to me was hope. And then from that point on, basically, my main focus was trying to prove how it wouldn't work. And as I kept going down the different bullet points and the different rabbit holes, I was like, shit, this thing could actually fucking work. This might be our real shot at hope. And at the same time, I was kind of getting into the greater free and open source movement. And so the open source movement mixed with Bitcoin was hope to me. And then most of my effort went into education. It was like, I say a lot, like the first step is like, put your mask, you're on a plane. This analogy doesn't work that well because of the COVID masks now, not the COVID mask, like oxygen mask. First, you put your own mask on, you learn about Bitcoin, you get more comfortable about it. And then the next step is try and help the people next to you. So then I embarked on a long journey focused on education. And I've just been obsessed with Bitcoin ever since.
So you guys do a show together, you and Marty, Rabbit Hole Recap, and you have a show, Citadel Dispatch, that, you know, is relatively new. Though I have to, you know, I have to tell you, Matt, it's a good show, and the content of the show is important for a lot of the reasons you just touched on when it comes to the whole whose mask are you putting on first thing. You got to learn about why and how and what the purpose of these tools are before you can teach other people. Now, you mentioned a few things there. Let's pull on a couple of those threads. The whole private tech, big tech, government collusion, coercion. This cocktail, to me, seems like something that everyone knows about. Everyone understands, I think, intuitively at this point. You know, if you're under 40 years old, you know that this is what's going on. But no one seems to care. I have an iPhone. You know, I'm sure a lot of people have iPhones in the audience. Android is like, you know, some of the worst when it comes to basically spyware in your pocket. I've heard you and others talk about the Ring network and the Alexas and the Apple HomePods and all these things. Incredible stuff, right? People actually have these things. They love them. And I'm wondering if you have like a thesis on why, especially young people, Matt, don't seem to care. They seem willing to trade convenience at the cost of having their entire lives surveilled at every opportunity. In fact, I think it's fair to say some people actually seek it out. They post stuff on TikTok. It's got their location behind them. It's location tagged. All this stuff, it seems to be so easy to understand, and yet everyone just continues to do it. Why? What are they missing, man?
Well, first off, so Rabbit Hole Recap, Marty basically seduced me to do Rabbit Hole Recap. I didn't want to do podcasting. He convinced me to go on his show, and then I started doing Rabbit Hole Recap with him weekly. And so I'm always grateful for him for that push. Like, he kind of pushed me over the ledge. I was a baby bird, and he was just like, fly. So like, we've been doing that for over 4.5 years, every week, week in, week out, covering the news. Dispatch, Citadel Dispatch is my own show. That's been about 2 years now. Then that's focused more on like going deep on the tech and actionable discussion. For what you said, like, yeah, we see that all day, every day, right? And it's easy to get disillusioned. My thesis is pretty simple. We've never been in this situation before. We've never had so much of our lives digitally surveilled and controlled. And as a result, what's happening is we're going to see more and more of these honeypots grow, right? Like you mentioned, the Ring system. People have these cameras that are located throughout their houses, pointed out to the street. You're walking your dog, your neighbors have it, you know, you're on their camera. That's all going to Amazon servers, right? Amazon is literally surveillance capitalism as a company, right? So their one of their main business models is collecting data on you and using it. They share that with the government. So all of these things, DNA companies, right? TikTok. These honeypots are growing. They've never been this big before. And so what I expect to happen is people are going to slowly get burned. We're going to see bigger and bigger leaks. We're going to see people get hurt as a result. We're going to see different consequences and results of those leaks and those hacks. We're going to see governments continue and routinely use it against their people. We saw a taste of that during the COVID lockdowns. And as a result, as that happens, people will get burned and then they will learn their lesson. And when they learn their lesson, the key is that we have the education and tools available for them so that they can seek out ways to empower themselves. And I will say the number one thing I hear is everyone, when you talk about privacy, everyone thinks the meme is, oh, I have nothing to hide, so I don't care, right? Like that is the reason people don't do it. The real thing that I see, the real hurdle point that I see with people is so many people have just thrown in the towel. They're like, I'm completely exposed already. There's nothing I can do, right? And one of the key things that I think is important for people to get and to understand now before it gets worse is little improvements do help. Little improvements help you personally, but then little improvements at scale, as more people do little improvements, do help everyone together. And it's not a lost cause. Like the number one thing I hear is that it's just a complete lost cause.
Yeah, I hear that a lot as well. And actually my co-host, who's, you know, a lot more privacy focused than me, after almost every show, we talk for like 5 or 10 minutes about the stream and what's coming up on the, you know, what's coming up on the business side. And almost every show, he tells me some other story. Like this Ring network has some kind of, is it true this has some kind of low frequency, always on mesh thing attached to it? Like, I don't know if that's true, but he told me that after the show the other day and I got to look this up. I wouldn't be surprised. You don't have to answer that now. Just something to think about. You mentioned there that you want to see incremental improvements. Yeah, incremental improvements at scale. I like this. Help me and help the people listening and watching who are maybe not as privacy inclined. Help us understand what are some of the most simple to make improvements that will have the biggest effect in terms of your privacy from both big tech, from government, and even from other people. I mean, we're kind of entering an era where everyone's carrying these devices in their pocket that have sensitive information. They're vulnerable. So what are the sort of options for people? You know, I'm not saying you have to push them out of the nest necessarily, to use your phrase, but just something small that people can do. What do you think?
There's little things, and it starts way before Bitcoin. Right? Like a lot of my conversations are about using Bitcoin privately, about the dangers of KYC, about on-chain privacy with Bitcoin. But the low-hanging fruit is way, way, way before all of that, right? Stuff like, you know, don't have an Amazon or Google wiretap in your kitchen. Just unplug it. And like, if you need to look up a recipe, like look up the recipe yourself instead of asking the fucking thing to set a timer, right? Don't send your DNA to these DNA companies that are just sharing the data everywhere. You're literally doxing your descendants before they're even born. Try and reduce social media. I know I'm a little bit of a hypocrite on that. Like people know I'm prolific on Twitter. Now I'm using Nostr more. Those are my only social media. Like I don't have Instagram. I don't have Facebook, LinkedIn, right? Like cut out as much of it as possible. Google's a fucking killer, man. Like try and cut Google out of your life. Little improvements there help. I talk about de-Googled Android phones. So Android phones that don't have Google on them. But before you even get to that step, just, you know, go to the top bar on your iPhone or your Android phone and disable the location. Like, is that perfect? Like, no, but if you have that disabled, it does help you a bit. And if you need to use like a Google Maps or something, then enable it at the time, right? If you want to look up the weather or whatever you're using your location for, enable it at the time, then immediately disable it again. Encrypted messaging, text messages are fucking horrible. Use Signal. Signal's great. I like Threema. Matrix is solid. And iMessage even. iMessage is not perfect. Way better than text messages. Text messages are basically a postcard. When you send a text message or an email, like everyone along the route can read what you're sending and who you're sending it to. Once again, little improvements help. Those I think are very easy, low-hanging fruit for people. And like I said, my doomer optimism kind of comes from the fact that people are just going to get burned on all these things and they're going to slowly learn over time. Like most people will not listen to a podcast or watch a show on YouTube and then as a result, do these things. But I think if we do get some people to do those things before people get burned, it kind of lowers the impact of those situations before they happen.
Okay, you're right about that. I think I want to pull on this FOSS thread a little bit, because there's, you know, I don't know if all the tools you mentioned are open source, I'll be honest with you, but it seems to me there's room for open source alternatives basically at every turn, whether it's messaging, data storage, you know, you name it, right? There's always something out there that's a little bit more transparent than the corporate option. Now, my question for you is, if you look back at a company like Apple is a good example, and their iMessage suite, there was a time when Apple was small enough that governments weren't knocking on the door and asking for backdoors into the devices, into the messaging, all this stuff. Do you think there's a real chance, Matt, that as these FOSS platforms grow in size, that governments won't do their best to co-opt them? Are they really immune to the same pressures that these giant multinationals thought they were immune to at one point? Or are we just being naive as these things grow?
And look, everything has trade-offs. The main trade-off when you use an open source tools is it's usually less polished and less convenient, right? Like usually we see a trade-off between security, privacy, and convenience, with closed source tools being more convenient. Now, open source tools, just something being open source is not an automatic win. But if you compare it to a closed source tool, it is. And why is that? It's because with open source code, you have two things. Well, first of all, we can get into hour-long debate on open source licenses, but you can basically put open source licenses in two buckets. You have code that anyone can view and verify, and then you have code that is free in open source software, which is not owned by anybody and is basically viral in nature. It outlives its creator. Anyone can modify it. Anyone can distribute it. Bitcoin is free in open source software. So as a result, no single entity controls it that can get pressured, right? So with free and open source software, you have this nice viral nature to it, where individuals and entities don't necessarily have control over it. If one of them gets pressured, they can walk away from the project. Someone else can take over the project. They can distribute their own version of the project. And as a result, it becomes kind of like a whack-a-mole situation. It's very hard to pressure those types of people. Now, if you have a more restrictive open source license, those people can obviously still be pressured. They control the code. No one else can modify and distribute it and monetize it. But at the same time, at least the code is verifiable. Now, in a perfect world, you're actually able to verify the code yourself and make sure what is running is what it says it does. But even if you're not, with more popular open source projects like Bitcoin, we do have a lot of skilled eyes on the code all the time, right? So if you compare that to a situation with Apple and iMessage, with iMessage, we're essentially trusting what Apple is saying it is doing, right? With Signal, the client is fully open source. So we can verify what the code is doing. We can verify that it's encrypting a client side before it sends the message, right? If they decide to switch that setup to enable scanning of the messages and viewing of the messages, someone will hopefully see that and will raise a flag, right? And now Signal is a little bit different because the servers are not open source. So someone can't easily distribute in a modified version. So maybe that just app just stops being used and we move to a different alternative, something like a Threema or a Matrix or something like that. But you have two different elements there, depending on what the open source license. Across the board for open source license, everyone can verify what is being run. And as a result, you can't get funny business by as easily. And then for proper open source software, free and open source software is actually viral in nature, where if any individual dies or gets pressured or something, other people can go and take the flag and keep running forward.
I agree with most of that. I guess the only thing I would ask you then, you know, as far as like this whack-a-mole thing, are you worried at all that what we've seen, you know, a good example of this might actually be the Bitcoin dev community and CSW's kind of nefarious actions against the developers. It's almost like the COVID action as well, right? It's not that you are going to have police or authorities or nefarious actors pressuring you to stop doing something all the time, right? It's not that you're always going to have someone there knocking at your door, but when a door gets knocked on, it's big news. And that person or that entity or that developer or whatever is made an example of, whether directly or indirectly, by the person who's looking to make the example or the state that's looking to make the example. Is this a concern? Because I look at this whack-a-mole thing, and to me, it makes sense right off the hop. But then I think pragmatically, honestly, in the last 2 years, 3 years maybe, it hasn't really worked that way. Do you have a view on that?
Look, the CSW, like, he can go fuck himself. He is a fraud. It is an attack on Bitcoin. It's an attack on Bitcoin developers. Some of our brightest minds, they've devoted so much time and energy. I mean, the only thing more scarce than Bitcoin is our time. And, you know, some of these guys have spent 8 years, 9 years working on Bitcoin, mostly for free without pay. And now their whole livelihoods are at risk because of this guy suing them and basically using the state against them. So it's a very real problem, and it's not something that should be belittled. Like, the whole Bitcoin community kind of needs to stand up here and support them. And we are, to a degree. There's a lot of things happening behind the scenes because of the nature of the situation. But it brings into the whole other aspect, which is privacy, right? And there's a reason CSW isn't suing Satoshi. I mean, he's pretending to be Satoshi, right? But Satoshi was
probably probably the main reason, right? I would say.
But Satoshi didn't connect his identity to his developer work, right? And as a result, I think this is one of those situations where a project like Bitcoin, right, stakes are very, very high. And it's a very unique project in the open source world as a result, because it's this distributed financial network that is moving billions of dollars around. And so it's at a scale that's unlike most other open source projects. And it's operating in an adversarial environment that is way higher than most open source projects. Because if you look at the history of governments trying to control their citizens or their subjects, depending on where you live, a main lever of control is financial privacy and financial transactions, right? Like, that is a very sensitive issue for governments that want to maintain control. So as a result, with Bitcoin, the stakes are very high. But my point is, I guess my long point here is that I think this is one of those touch the stove, getting burnt type of situation, right? And maybe I'm being a hypocrite because you see my face right here, right? But I think this is why early Bitcoiners were so adamant. When I first got into Bitcoin, everyone was NIMs, right? Before Marty seduced me, like, I was only a NIM in Bitcoin. I think developers are starting to realize why it's important for them to do their work not under their legal identity, without their face being publicly shown. And I think we will, as a result, have more NIM contributors, more privacy-focused contributors that are not necessarily connected to their legal identity. And I think as a result, like, this is, you know, obviously not a great situation. It's not great for the devs that are being targeted directly. It's not great for Bitcoin. But long term, it will make Bitcoin stronger, because we will have more contributors that are doing so with a privacy-first mindset.
So let's transition then to privacy. And it's a subject that I would say, Matt, you're probably the face of, as far as Twitter and Bitcoin and accessibility to the topic. I know, you know, when I look for content on privacy, it's usually your name that comes up, or Ben BTC Sessions, who's doing tutorials of that nature. And so this is important work, I think, and something that all of us need to do better on, and hopefully something that Bitcoin will help the average person with. We've seen over the last 2 years, I'm thinking of one incident in particular involving the truckers, of course, where, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the protest, financial consequences were doled out pretty harshly. It was a big bat, big stick, and a broad brush on application. And a lot of those people suddenly found themselves looking for something like Bitcoin without maybe knowing the ins and outs. So I want to ask you maybe first on this topic, why do you think financial privacy is sort of, you know, if you think this, I think probably it's safe to say you do, you know, sort of king of the hierarchy of needs when it comes to being a person that's involved in the financial network, the financial marketplace?
Well, the way I look at it is if you don't have privacy, you don't have freedom, because if everything you do is known by, so privacy is not secrecy, right? Mm-hmm. Privacy is the ability to selectively reveal yourself to the world. Eric Hughes wrote this 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago to the day. He wrote it March 9th, 1993. Privacy is the ability to choose what the world sees. It's not to be Jason Bourne. You don't have to be a ninja. It's you get to choose what you want to share with and who you want to share it with, right? And if you don't have privacy, you don't have freedom, because as a result, not only do you end up self-censoring yourself, but you're easily pressured because you don't have privacy. And then if you don't have freedom, you can't have wealth, because if you're not free, it's not really your wealth. It can just be taken from you at will. So at the core of the whole thing is privacy. And I think the Canadian trucker situation was another touch the stove moment. And it's really interesting to me because I've been working with activists through the Human Rights Foundation for almost 5 years now. And we see these pain points all day, every day, right? If you're in Russia in the opposition party and you're trying to raise funds through Bitcoin, privacy is of paramount importance. Like, you want to make sure that your donors are not known to Putin. Same thing in Venezuela or Iran or Belize, right? All these places, they understand living in an adversarial environment and how much financial privacy can be used against the individual. And with the Canadian situation, it was the first time really that Westerners kind of saw it firsthand, and Westerner Bitcoiners. I think there was a lot of Bitcoiners that were kind of just blinders on. I mean, I had a tweet, because I get so frustrated sometimes because of the work I do with activists, and people don't realize, because it comes out on Rabbit Hole Recap, and they don't realize like why I'm getting frustrated. But it's because I see the pain points on a daily basis. And I had a tweet like a year before the Canadian truckers, and I was like, you are an activist raising money in an adversarial environment and you want to accept Bitcoin. How do you do it? All the answers fucking sucked, right? And some of the answers were completely naive. And they were like, we have no, like, this tooling already exists. It's super easy to do, blah, blah, blah. And then the Canadian truckers happened, and I have the utmost respect for BTC Sessions. He's a brother to me, but like, he's one of our leading educators, and he was leading the fundraise and fucked it up. Like, that's how difficult it was to use Bitcoin privately in an adversarial environment. Now the tools are getting better. They're getting significantly better. But that is a priority. And the thing is, it needs to be accessible privacy. Like, it needs to be relatively easy for the average person to do, because little fuck ups will completely screw you. And we've seen that on the internet, period. I mean, everyone knows the Streisand effect. It's hard to delete things from the internet. Well, the blockchain is forever, right? If we're correct about Bitcoin, this thing's going to outlive all of us. It's going to outlive our grandkids. You make a mistake on the blockchain, they might not even, like, someone, a malicious entity might not be able to track you at this moment, but that record on the blockchain is going to stay there forever. And maybe 5 years, 6 years, 7 years down the line, they get some kind of external data that connects, you know, one address to another address or something. And then it fucks you. And you don't know until it's too late. You don't know until they're knocking on your door, closing your bank accounts, trying to push you out of your home. Like, that's the moment when you realize. And at that point, it's too late. So the stakes are incredibly high. And then the positive spin of the Canadian trucker situation is it made people more aware. It made builders focus more on these types of tools and this type of accessibility. The negative take is a lot of people have already forgotten about it. Like, obviously this is a Canada focused show. I'm glad you guys haven't forgot about it, but people moved on relatively quickly. Like, it was like a everyone freak out moment. And then 6 months later, 7 months later, a lot of people have already forgotten, and it's going to take multiple of those over and over again. And my thesis is basically the tools get more robust every time. As it happens, as these pain points get hit and they become more exposed, the tools will get better and better and better. And that's how we ultimately win at the end of the day.
The most disappointing thing for me about the protest and about these other stove touching moments that you mentioned is that we, you know, sort of the royal we, get excited about the moment when Bitcoin should shine, and we immediately translate that to the price should rip soon based on this. And when it doesn't, invariably we forget, and it happens all the fucking time, and it drives me crazy as well. So I'm glad you brought that up. We shouldn't be forgetting these things. Now, when it comes to tools for Bitcoin privacy, there are many. You know, there's some L2 stuff. There's some, you know, applications for your computer, for your phone, different wallets, different variables in those wallets. What do you recommend for the average kind of, I don't want to say new coiner, Matt, but someone who maybe uses Blue Wallet with Sparrow or something like that? What do you recommend for that person, or uses the Ledger suite of products or the Trezor suite of products? You know, there's better tools than that. You know, to be honest with you, it doesn't seem like they have much of a marketing budget. Honestly, if I didn't listen to all these Bitcoin podcasts, I wouldn't know anything about any of this stuff. I would just be looking at what's available on big box retail sites, going on Amazon to buy wallets, whatever, looking on Twitter for stuff. But generally, I think a lot of people don't know just how easy the access is to some of these tools. So what are they?
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is search Bitcoin wallet in either the Android app store or the iPhone app, the iPhone store. And like all the top results.
Do you really not know that the app store is just called the app store on an iPhone? This is really, this is a watershed moment here. Millennial doesn't know what the app store is called.
Today I learned, if you search Bitcoin wallet, they're all garbage, right? Like you mentioned Sparrow, you mentioned Blue, none of those show up. I mean, Sparrow's desktop, right? But none of them show up. Like I had, Sergey on from Bitrefill, and like the wallets that most people pay him from are just absolute garbage wallets that Bitcoin Twitter just never talks about. And that's the reality of the situation. So, little improvements once again do help. I like to kind of frame it in different ways. Well, first of all, the risk of KYC. Everyone should at least understand what they're doing when they're buying from one of these regulated exchanges, right? You're giving them your identification information. You're giving them, you know, if you're an American, you're giving them your social security number, you're giving them your driver's license. Now they take face scans and stuff, street address. All that information is stored forever, very insecurely. Shared with governments, hacked, leaked, bought, sold. And that information is connected to your withdrawal addresses, right? So even though your Bitcoin address does not say like Odell or Joey, connecting to that external data connects it to that address, right? So that's a massive exposure point for most Bitcoiners. There's ways to buy Bitcoin without KYC. There's ways to buy Bitcoin with minimal KYC. So I would say like minimal KYC would be something like an ATM where it requires a phone number. Even if that's your own phone number, that's still significantly better than passport, face scan, yada, yada, yada. But if you use a burner number, that's even better, right? And then there's things like RoboSats, Bisc, HODL, Peach, that enable peer-to-peer trading. Now, when you do peer-to-peer trading, if you're sending from a bank account or Venmo or Strike, or Cash App or something, like that fiat side of the equation is obviously there's a tracking element there, but once again, better than full KYC from a privacy exposure point. And ultimately at the end of the day, cash trades, mining Bitcoin, you're just literally plugging in a miner into power and internet. Mining Bitcoin and earning Bitcoin for goods and services, right? Circular Bitcoin economy, ultimately, I think, will mitigate most of the risks of KYC long-term, because people won't buy Bitcoin, they'll earn Bitcoin, they won't sell Bitcoin, they'll spend Bitcoin. So those are ways to mitigate your KYC risk, but just know it's out there. If you do use a KYC service, if you do use one of these regulated services like Cash App or Swan or Strike, that's your exposure on that side. Now, the first step is take self-custody. If someone else is holding your keys, you know, if someone else is holding your Bitcoin, not only can they rug you at will, but they also have full insight into every transaction you make, right? And it's important for us to frame this conversation properly, right? Because if you're using Venmo or Cash App or something as a with fiat, with just dollars, right? Whether that's US dollars, Canadian dollars, whatever, like all those transactions are obviously tracked and reported and surveilled and used against you. With Bitcoin, you have the option to opt out of that, right? So the first step is take self-custody. You want to take self-custody. You want to hold your keys yourself. I really like CoinKite's products. I like Cold Card. It's my favorite. Seed Signer is really solid. Hold your keys yourself, ideally cold storage, right? But before you even get to cold storage, you know, use a mobile wallet, right? Use a Blue wallet or a Samurai wallet or a Moon or something, or Phoenix, right? And play with Bitcoin. Actually, like, get comfortable with it. Use it, send, receive transactions, back it up, restore it, right? Get comfortable with it. But then ultimately, for long-term savings, you want to have it in cold storage. And not only are you holding your keys yourself, but they're not online, so you're less likely to get hacked, right? Like, that's like the low-hanging fruit. You want to do that first. I really like Sparrow Wallet to coordinate those transactions with your hardware wallet. Sparrow is available on Linux, Mac, and Windows. Don't use Windows, but if you have to, whatever.
Too late.
At least hold your keys offline. So yeah, that's the key, right? Then the next step is use your own node. And why do you want to use your own node? Because if you're not using your own node, you're using someone else's node. A node is basically the way you are able to interact with the distributed network that is Bitcoin, right? The node does two things. The node verifies that the rules of the network are what you think they are. The most common rule that everyone's obsessed with, 21 million Bitcoin, your node is making sure that no one's printing Bitcoin, right? But it's also making sure that no other rules are being changed without your consent, right? So your node, it does not have auto update enabled. And as a result, if you want to change the rules that your node verifies, you have to update to new software with new rules, right? So you want to use your own node to verify the rules of the network. And then second of all, your node is broadcasting transactions and also is also checking the chain to see when you receive transactions. So if you're using someone else's node, you're trusting them with your privacy. So first step is understand the risks of KYC. Second step is hold self-custody, hold your Bitcoin yourself. It's extremely empowering. It's way easier than you think it is. Third step is to use your own node. And then once you get past that step, then you start to think about what can I do for actually using Bitcoin more privately. Maybe if you use the KYC service, you're trying to break that trail. That KYC record will always be there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that with that KYC record, all your future transactions should be tracked or can be tracked, right? And that's where collaborative transactions come into play. The most common is CoinJoin. I like Whirlpool. I like Join Market. I have issues with Wasabi, the company, because they're complicit with chain surveillance companies. But even something like Wasabi is way better than not using anything, right? And so in that situation, what is a collaborative transaction? And it's such a, everything in this space is just so drama filled. So I'll probably get shit for that comment I just made. But what is a collaborative transaction? A collaborative transaction is essentially multiple people in a transaction are contributing inputs. They're contributing Bitcoin. And then as a result, it makes it harder to track the transaction on chain. So how do we think about this? When there's chain surveillance companies that are specifically mercenaries, all they do is try and track your transactions. How do they track your transactions? They do so using probability analysis. Bitcoin is unique compared to the traditional financial system. With the traditional financial system, like, you can't send a bank transfer to yourself from the one account to the same account. Like, that would be ridiculous. I don't know what your bank would do if you tried to wire yourself 20K from the same account. But with Bitcoin, you can do that, right? So the chain surveillance company is basically trying to figure out when ownership changes hands. Did Joey send himself Bitcoin or did Joey send Matt Bitcoin? And try and figure out when that ownership change happens. So by including multiple people in a transaction and all sending the same amount at the same time, you can break that probability analysis on chain, right? So if there's five of us in a collaborative transaction in a coin join, we're all sending the same amount. The simple thing is, okay, the outputs could be one of five people. You don't know which it is, right? And as you do more coin joins, you compound that effect. And it makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to track through when you do that. And that's like the basic premise of trying to use Bitcoin privately. Then Lightning, you know, is like a fucking rabbit hole in itself about using it privately. In general, sending on Lightning is way more private than receiving on Lightning. It's hard to receive on Lightning privately. I have like 2-hour conversations on Dispatch about the different nuances about using Lightning privately. But I will say that before you can start using Lightning privately, you need to understand the on-chain element. Because if you're using Doc's Bitcoin, if you're using Bitcoin that's tied to your name, and those are the Bitcoin that are being used to open your channels when you're using Lightning, you've already fucked, right? You might get some improvements over sending a regular Bitcoin transaction. Once again, there's nuances, but you have to understand the on-chain footprint, and you have to understand how these adversaries are kind of using it against you before you can even get to that step.
So this is a good time to ask. A friend of the show, Massa Capital, sent me a message, and he wants to know if you think the main risk to Bitcoin at the moment is this kind of, you know, quote unquote choke point, something like what Nick Carter wrote about, you know, maybe a week or two ago. And you're mentioning the privacy tools. And the reason I want to ask it now is because what we've seen is that if you use your KYC Bitcoin in a coin join or in one of these other multiple input transaction methods, the exchange will flag you and tell you, no more. If you want to do that, do
only
it
some
else.
Will. Yeah.
Some will. Are you worried that this is going to become a larger problem? Or is this a case where maybe you can arbitrage and go to exchanges that are, you know, less friendly to that kind of pressure will succeed, while those who are more friendly to it will kind of fall by the wayside?
It's important to realize that a lot do not yet. There are some that do, and they will close your account if you use CoinJoin. So CoinJoin on chain is very visible. It's very obvious you're doing collaborative transaction. I consider that almost a one-to-one comparison to message encryption, right? If you're sending an encrypted message, the data carrier knows you're sending an encrypted message. And if you think about it at the most basic encryption message level, like PGP, GPG, like it's obvious that's an encrypted message that's being sent. But the thing is because of encryption, they don't know what is actually in the message, right? So we have seen people historically be pressured because they're using encrypted communications. I had Johar on my Freedom Money series that was released today, and she's an Uyghur in China. And like just using encryption is a criminal offense because they do not live in a free country. Right? The dictators are the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party is like, if you use encryption, you have something to hide and we're going to fucking throw you in a prison camp. In that environment, right? CoinJoin is exactly in a very similar situation there. Now, I would say people should operate under the situation that most on-ramps are going to be shut down. Like I've been operating under that situation for way long. I'm not going to say told you so on that one either, because I've just been expecting that for years now. Specifically on ramps that allow you to even self-custody. Like when you think about the war on private Bitcoin, it's not going to stop at CoinJoin. It's going to be pressure people into choosing not to self-custody. And if you do self-custody, maybe you have to report everything. And if they catch you in a lie, they'll make an example of you. And as a result, as we saw with the COVID lockdowns, 99% of people are going to comply, right? So this is kind of the threat model that I'm expecting already. And as a result, the way I look at it is like, to me, I mean, a lot of people that are listening might know me from my daily Stayumble Stack Sats. Stacking sats to me is not a trading strategy, right? It's not to make more dollars. It's an exit strategy. It's leaving the fiat system behind. It's opting out of the system, right? And when you start to view it as an exit strategy, then of course you don't want those transactions tracked after they leave the regulated exchange. And of course, if you get blocked out of that exchange, then so be it. Go figure out another way to accumulate Bitcoin, right? And as a result, I think it goes back to everything else we said, that it's actually a weird situation where, first of all, if this attack on Bitcoin happens, which it kind of seems like it is happening. But once again, I've been calling that for years. first of all, there's a whole slew of Bitcoiners that are going to consider this bullish, right? Like Twitter's going to consider it bullish. This is regulatory clarity. They love the words regulatory clarity. This opens up Bitcoin as an investment asset for a whole new class of investors that have just been really worried about being able to do this in a proper regulated cucked way. And as a result, the Bitcoin price might pump in that situation. But I think what happens after that is circular economies are forced to develop quicker. I think P2P exchanges are forced to develop quicker. I think self-custody tools are forced to develop quicker and be more robust in an adversarial environment. And as a result, Bitcoin as freedom money actually kind of gets born out of those ashes, right? Like kind of gets, you know, it's the pressure, that pressure that gets pushed onto it results in Bitcoin being stronger as an actual self-sovereign money. And, you know, maybe there's painful moments in between, but I would just say to anyone out there who's like, oh, I'm not going to coin join because I'm afraid I'm not going to spend it in the future. Like if you can't go to your local corner store and buy a sandwich with certain Bitcoin, but you can buy it with other Bitcoin, all of us are fucked. Like the system's failed. Like that is not just like, oh, like laugh at the Bitcoiners who use CoinJoin and like practice privacy best practices. It's like, no, like Bitcoin has failed as money because you have to ask permission of the state to spend it in the first place.
It's, you know, there's a lot to be said about this idea that every sat is worth a sat. And, you know, I don't want to get into ordinals or anything like that, or, you know, this other stuff that's going on, but like, it's just, it's
please
nuts.
God,
you know what I mean?
No.
Like, it's crazy. I know you did 2 hours with Casey. God bless you. I was pulling my hair out listening to that a couple of times. Cause I can kind of, I could like imagine your face like, okay. And he's telling you, your eyes are glazing over. I was cracking up. But anyway, two more things I want to talk about. And then I got to ask you about your foot speed. Tell me a bit about what you're doing at 1031, because there's a lot of people who, when you came out with that, gave you guys, the whole team, a bunch of shit. This is fiat, it's venture funding, it's equity, it's, you know, pump and dump, it's all this kind of fiat stuff. I don't really have a view on that. If I look at your portfolio companies, you mentioned a few of them tonight, you were talking your book earlier, nice job there. And what, you know, all those companies are good Bitcoin companies. So why are those people wrong when they say this is a bullshit fiat scam being run by guys who suddenly find themselves with a little bit of clout and a little bit of cash?
It's easy to talk your book when you only try and support the companies and the tools that you actually use and appreciate in the first place. I don't know. Look, I spent a lot of time in Bitcoin on the education side. Saw a lot of pain points, developed very strong bonds with a lot of Bitcoiners. I see these billion, we saw all these billion-dollar crypto funds and Silicon Valley funds come in, and like they, what are they funding? They're funding like WorldCoin. You know, they're like scanning global, people in the global south, they're like scanning their irises and like airdropping them shit coins that the VCs have pre-mined, and they're saying like it's changing the world. They're funding OpenSea. They funded Ethereum to begin with. They funded Solana. You know, just garbage, just absolute garbage, burning all this money. But fuck the money. Like, I don't care that they're burning that money because it's not my money. It's some other schmuck's money, right? So, like, that part doesn't really bother me. But what bothers me is seeing, like, very good Bitcoin projects and Bitcoin companies struggle to get funding in that environment. So first what happened was I started OpenSats, and that was 100% pass-through nonprofit, supporting open source projects, no strings attached, right? Because I saw all these open source projects that they were just not getting funding. And then this opportunity presented itself to help launch 1031 with the other guys on the team. And it was an opportunity that, first of all, like, it's not completely selfless. Like, obviously, like, I stand to make money off of it. But supporting these companies that are focused on this long-term Bitcoin vision, right? Only Bitcoin companies. A lot of them are freedom-oriented. right? Of course, like the big ticket ones, like no one, everyone knows the big ticket ones, like a strike or whatever, right? But like companies like Peach, right? A small P2P trading app that's launched by this wonderful woman named Steph, who is a good friend already. And like most venture funds or family offices or, you know, institutional money would not touch that with a 10-foot pole, right? Companies like Samurai, companies like CoinKite, right? CoinKite hates, like NVK is a good friend. He hates venture funding, right? we see a lot of these companies that a lot of these founders just completely do not trust anyone in the investment world. And then also simultaneously, we see a lot of investors that are too scared to actually go, you know, knees deep, get deep into the tech and like actually work with these founders and kind of think long-term in the vision. So there's a unique opportunity there. I don't like doing things that someone else is already doing. If someone else is doing something and they're effective at it, they should do it. It's better for that. Better for me if they do it, right? Time is extremely scarce, but no one else was really doing it. And we saw this opportunity and basically what we're doing is, and like the biggest argument that I've heard is like, that were like trying to take the plebs money and like they should be buying Bitcoin instead. Like I literally say, stay humble, stack sats every morning. Like they should go stay humble and stack sats, right? Like for 99% of the world, people should stay humble and stack sats. But there's a large group of investors around the world, high net worth individuals, family offices, endowments that maybe own Bitcoin, but they can't allot 100% of their endowment or their family office into Bitcoin, the asset. And they're going to go and invest in Silicon Valley VCs. They're going to go invest in crypto VCs. Instead, they give us the money. We go and get them way better deals than they get from any of those other venture funds because they're investing in good, solid Bitcoin companies. And then these founders and these teams that are working on real issues get the funding they need. So everybody wins in that situation. And you can just look like... We've been operating for a year and a half. We're already the largest Bitcoin-only venture fund in the world. We've supported over 30 companies. And meanwhile, SBF and FTX, which by the way, no one could have seen coming, but we all saw it fucking coming. They had a $5.4 billion venture fund, right? That invested in over 100 companies and tokens and shitcoins and all this shit. We had zero overlap. Right. I know it's like it's a weird selling point. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back too much, but like none of our companies rugged users. None of them went bankrupt. Right. They're all building the Bitcoin future that we all seem to want. They're mostly companies that most people that are listening to the show right now use every day, but they just couldn't get funding. And it's been a really interesting experience because I'm definitely, you know, not your typical venture suit, you know, Patagonia wearing guy. And it's just been really interesting and weird and strange and fun being in that world. Because it is really like most people are just so detached. They don't realize the difference. Most people don't even know that there's a difference between crypto and Bitcoin. Right.
Yeah.
And that's our unique place in the world. And if you're doing anything right, you're always going to have haters. So I have no intention of stopping. The rest of the team has no intention of stopping. And if you talk to any of our founders, they're very happy with us. And if you talk to any of our investors, they're very happy with us. And that's all that really matters on that front.
That's a check the scoreboard moment for you guys. You guys did a good job, I thought, parrying a lot of those attacks, you know, a year and a half ago and continue to today. Now, tell me what's next for Bitcoin Park. Because I haven't seen Bitcoin Park. I'm a poor Bitcoin.
Come visit.
I haven't looked. Maybe I will. But you got to tell me what. First of all, where did this? What did you build? It's like a repurposed apartment complex. Like what the fuck is this thing? Like I hear you guys doing RHR, and you're talking about guys walking by in the hall. There's other rooms, other podcast studios. What the fuck is going on over there?
Yeah. I mean, Bitcoin Park's a fucking crazy idea. So I'm obviously obsessed with Bitcoin. And as a result, I do all these different things in the Bitcoin space. And one of them is Bitcoin Park. And a lot of the things I focus on are like community oriented, right? Community oriented, education oriented, and helping builders build, right? and content creation. Obviously, I produce a lot of content. I consume a lot of content. And I think that would kind of go on the education side and also kind of complement everything else. So Bitcoin Park is at the core is building and empowering a local community here in Nashville. And then going further than that and helping other community organizers around the world empower their local communities. And a perfect example is that the first event we ever held at Bitcoin Park was called Grassroots Bitcoin. And the idea there was it was invite only, completely free. We're going to make it annual. And the only way you can get an invite was if you were a meetup organizer. If you were a meetup organizer, fly in 2 days, you know, at Bitcoin Park, and we all talk, have a fun time, but also we work, right? And we're like, how do we empower our other local communities? And when you start to think about Bitcoin, it's easy to be like Bitcoin is just code, right? It's like a tech project. But ultimately, it's a movement of people. It's a movement of individuals. Like, we need individuals to stand up and actually use these tools. And that's where the real progress is made, is on this local level. So Bitcoin Park is this campus. We have co-working space there. We have event space. We run 2 free to the public meetups every month, BitDevs and a local and a topical meetup. We get like over 200 people for our monthly meetups. The community in Nashville is booming. We're trying to do things a little bit differently and interesting. Like, there was a lot of pushback by me from all these conferences, like massive conference fatigue. So very intimate, small events. The topic for a month will always be the same topic every month going forward, every year going forward. So like January was mining. Every January would be mining. You can plan your calendar around it. In the Midwest of America, we see a lot of people driving from like 7 hours, 6 hours away. February was free open source software. It'll always be free open source software. July is Lightning. Will always be Lightning. Grassroots was September. Will always be Grassroots. So that's kind of how we're looking at it. As for the specific campus, the previous tenants was this country pop band called Florida Georgia Line. So they actually built out the whole space. And that's why it has all these quote unquote podcast studios. It's really their music studios are what they are. They're not podcast studios. And they had like this whole, there's 2 buildings right next to each other. They're very close to Vanderbilt and Belmont University. So we're getting a lot of the young kids in. We're getting them interested in Bitcoin, which, by the way, like, the shit corners are all over those kids, right? Like, they come in with their laptops and they got Ledger and Tron and Solana all over their laptops and stuff. And we just basically like trial by fire, just like pulled them into Bitcoin. But yeah, so like we took over this space because the band broke up. And people ask, you know, like, what is the secret sauce of Bitcoin Park? Like, how do I emulate it in my own community? Well, first of all, everyone should come down and visit, because if you don't see it in person, like, you don't understand the scope and the scale of it. Like, it's fucking ambitious. But the secret is we're just losing a shit ton of money right now. And we're willing to lose a bunch of sats trying to prove out the concept, but I think we can make it sustainable. And I think it can be, it'll be like legacy shit. Like, that's what I'm hoping this thing just is there forever. And grows past me and my co-founder Rod, and just, you know, has new young guys running it, and just it just keeps going, and the community around it just gets stronger and stronger.
Absolutely killer answer. I'm happy to hear that you're continuing that excursion even with the loss on the balance sheet. Now look, Matt, you've been a great guest. we have a lot of fun with our guests, and I think by now. Oh man, we've been doing the show almost 2 years. I must have asked some of the best, most popular, most well-known Bitcoiners how fast they are. And, you know, I mentioned it off the top of the hour here that your co-host was on our show last year, I think, probably around this time last year, actually. And he did the show from his side yard, maybe. I forget where he did it from. He looked very relaxed. And
Beach house.
He didn't care at all what was going on with the question, okay? And he didn't think twice when he's like, oh yeah, I'd fucking dust him in a foot race, 40 yards, no problem. Went on to talk about how he was the speed guy in lacrosse, blah, blah, blah. Had ACL surgery, still faster than you. Now, I don't know how tall you are, but you look pretty wiry. And in my experience, wiry guys can run. So do you think you could beat Marty in a foot race or no? 40 yards.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I got tagged in the tweet. And I just immediately was game for the race. I look, first of all, I'm a competitive person, so I will always do the race no matter what. But I think it was telling that I said I was down to do the race, and then he immediately tried to move it to sand. Which, by the way, like, to be clear, he might have me beat on sand because I'm not a surfer. He's a surfer. Like, he runs on sand all the fucking time. You know, how many times have I run on sand in my life? Maybe like twice. Like, I don't know. But like, he just immediately tried to push it to sand. But I think I'm pretty fast. I've never actually raced him in a foot race. But yeah, I think I'm a pretty fast guy. I have a question for you. Okay. If you want to talk about like privacy and control and stuff, like the single worst place to be is in a customs line or like a border patrol line. Like, you know, you realize that CBP is Customs and Border Patrol of America, right? Like, that's like the initials.
I didn't know that.
No, like all my event, my like calendar invite and stuff. It's just like, I just feel like the CBP is just bringing me in for an inquisition.
No, none of that. Don't worry about it. Okay, Matt, tell people, I mean, not that they don't know, but as always, the handoff at the end of the show, where can people find out more about you?
How fast are you?
You brought it up on the show. You know, listen, I'm very fast, very fast.
Do you think you can outrun Marty?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? I'll kill anyone. Actually, at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference, we just announced last week on the show that I'll race anybody, any comers. But I'm not doing it for free. You got to bet, because I'll crush people all day long. I'm the best athlete
bets.
I know.
Bets are important. It's proper skin in the game.
And I tore my Achilles around this time last year, and I'm still fucking crushing people running, playing football every Saturday. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care, buddy. But yeah, Matt, tell people, okay, you mentioned Freedom Money during the show. When you give your handoff here, tell people where they can find you, but tell them about Freedom Money. It's a new series that just started releasing, I think last week or 2 weeks ago was the first one, right?
We've released 5 episodes. Mm-hmm. This is the first season of Freedom Money. I did it in partnership with Bitcoin Magazine. It was a whole nother level for me because it was like 4K cameras and just very aggressive, you know, just very high quality, overly produced, or not overly produced, but heavily produced. So it's Freedom Money is me interviewing activists from around the world and Bitcoin builders as well. Great crew of people, very important topics. You should definitely consider watching and listening. You can find that by searching Freedom Money on YouTube. It's on Bitcoin Magazine's YouTube, but if you search Freedom Money, it comes right up. Hopefully we'll have a podcast feed for that or something in the future. This is basically like the pilot season. We weren't able to go back to 1031, right? Like, if the show was called Number Go Up, we would have been able to sell it to a million different sponsors. Right. But because the show was called Freedom Money, and because I refused to take a KYC sponsor, because that would just be ridiculous, like Freedom Money, like powered by OKCoin or something, we got no sponsorship for it. So, like, the Bitcoin Magazine Conference sponsored it. Like, Bitcoin Magazine took on all the production costs themselves. So, they should be applauded for that. I do appreciate them working with me on that. But yeah, search Freedom Money on YouTube. Really great conversations. I have Citadel Dispatch, as we mentioned. There's a YouTube channel for that as well. If you search Citadel Dispatch or in your favorite podcast app. And then we have Rabbit Hole Recap that you can search in your favorite podcast app or on YouTube as well. On YouTube, the Rabbit Hole Recap feed shares a YouTube with Marty's TFTC. But if you search Rabbit Hole Recap on YouTube or your podcast app, it will pop up. And those are my 3 shows right now. There's also Bitcoin Park as a podcast feed because I wasn't done with just having those podcast feeds. So if you search Bitcoin Park in your podcast app, you can actually listen to a lot of the content that happens at our monthly meetups and our summits. Now, you won't get all the content there because we let panelists at Bitcoin Park choose if it gets published or not before and after they have an ability to opt out. So some don't get published. Also, the way we do panels at Bitcoin Park is 30 minutes plus 15 minute Q&A. The Q&A never gets published. So you have to show proof of work, actually come down to Bitcoin Nice. Park if you want to hear the Q&A. And the Q&A is usually the most spicy part.
Outstanding. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching, everyone. Make sure you go check out what Matt's doing, and we will talk to you next week. Good job. Way to go.